Greetings. This is Alfred Wallace with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, May 7th, 2016. We'll begin today's reading with the local news. First, Illinois agriculture industry opened for increased exports. Taylorville. Mario Godinez was impressed by what he saw Monday during a tour of the GSI production facility in Taylorville. GSI, which is owned by AGCO, manufactures equipment for the swine and poultry industry at the plant, said Tom Stuffman, the company's director for North American protein. Godinez, 19, is among a group of pork producers from Mexico, China, and Colombia, visiting the United States this week to learn about the agriculture industry. Godinez says he helps out on his father's pig farm in Mexico and wants to benefit from his first of its kind trip to the United States. GSI has some eye-opening technology, he said. Improving the pig farm with it is something we're looking forward to. The tour is organized through the Illinois Department of Agriculture in an effort to increase export sales for the Illinois pork industry. Similar tours in the past 20 years have generated more than $11 million in sales for participating Illinois agribusinesses. Department Director Raymond Poe hoped the visitors could benefit from the experience. We hope you learn things to take home, Poe said to the group, which includes 10 participants from Mexico, 13 from China, and 3 from Colombia. Through the Illinois Pork Tour, we can build relationships between foreign buyers and Illinois agribusinesses in the hopes of growing our industry and improving our export sales. Supporting agribusinesses such as GSI is an important way to boost the local economy, said State Representative Avery Bourne, Republican from Raymond. Agriculture is so much more than cultivating crops, Bourne said. GSI is attempting to incorporate all of the latest technology into its equipment, Stuthman said. The plant in Taylorville is one of 14 GSI manufacturing plants around the world, including 4 in Illinois, he said. Feeding, ventilation, and confinement equipment from the Automated Production Systems International and Cumberland divisions are made at the Taylorville facility, Stuthman said. The company has been participating as one of the stops on the Department of Agriculture Foreign Trade Tour every other year, Stuthman said. The visit is timed so that the group can stop at the World Pork Expo later this week in Des Moines, Iowa. Before then, Godinez is looking forward to seeing other destinations in Illinois, including the Chicago Board of Trade. With so much of their grain coming to the United States, Godinez says he wants to better understand how the market works. He thinks seeing the Board of Trade can provide a beneficial learning opportunity. Other planned stops during the tour include Cedar Ridge Farms in Redbud, the National Soybean Research Laboratory at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, Prairie State Semen Incorporated in Champaign, and Amlin International in Vernon Hills. Next, today is day 3 in a series of how the heroin addiction epidemic is striking the Decatur area, with addicts aren't the only ones who need a helping hand. Mount Zion. Hearing a 35-year-old addict say things her son might have said made Kathy Burkham apprehensive. That's because Tyler Yount's decision to use heroin one more time, after staying clean for 11 months and 2 weeks, was the last one he ever made. He overdosed on June 14, 2009, dying at age 23. "You need to get treatment ASAP. I'm begging you to go," she said, the desperation unmistakable in her voice. "I don't want your mom to do the things I had to do as a mother, and my boys had to do as a brother, and my husband had to do as a dad." The forum, a new support group called Addiction, Awareness, and Beyond, springs from the full scope of the damage caused by addiction. According to David Vail, a substance abuse counselor at the Substance Abuse Treatment Center at HSHS St. Mary's Hospital, each addict affects at least 7 other lives. "This is a family disease," he said. Led by Geraldine Schreiner, her daughter Erica Alford and other family members, and by Jeff DeVore. The group started meeting every other Monday earlier this year at Our Lady of the Holy Spirit Catholic Church in Mount Zion to work together on getting loved ones the help they need. The overarching discussion at a recent meeting involved getting easier access to medically assisted treatment. Shriner's son Nick, the one for whom Burkham was afraid, said he wants to undergo medical detox, something that's not available in Decatur. Nobody wants to be dope sick, he said. Even if he managed to get the drug out of his system, Shriner said he couldn't afford the cost of methadone because his insurance doesn't cover it. Faith Curtis, who has been a regular at the meetings, supports wider availability of naltrexone, an injectable drug that blocks the effects of opioids like heroin for 30 days. She believes it would help her son, Austin Wells, 29, who has been in prison since January after flunking out of Macon County Hybrid Court, because patients cannot have an opioid in their system, or the shot will cause devastating withdrawal symptoms. It would be wonderful if every heroin or opioid addict getting out of prison or out of rehab could automatically get a shot on their way out, Curtis said. But Wells would probably still have to consent, something that has frustrated her to no end as she's tried to do what's best for him. Curtis recalls the time she arranged for him to stay at the Genesis Men's Home in St. Louis for a year upon his release from the Macon County Jail, but he refused and chose a 90-day treatment center in Chicago that didn't work out. He says he doesn't want to go to jail either, but he's there, isn't he? Curtis said. It's like the system doesn't want you involved or hear what you have to say because he's an adult. She said her son started on the opiate train at 22, after having surgery for a herniated disc and taking the hydrocodone the surgeon prescribed, while Shriner said he started drinking at 14 and got hooked on heroin 6 years ago. An opiate makes some people's brains light up like crazy, Curtis said. I've taken hydrocodone before, and it doesn't even really seem to help my pain. One action Addiction Awareness and Beyond recently took was to pass out flyers about the group at the May 17th meeting of the Mount Zion School Board, when the board approved a random drug testing policy for high school students involved in extracurricular activities. Burkham said addiction brought out the best and worst in her as a mother, and she can never forget calling her son a junkie in a text message the night he relapsed. I'm horribly ashamed of the judgmental person I was, and swear never to be again. Addiction taught me what to be and what not to be as a person, a mom, and as a friend. I walked in those shoes alone, and now I feel like I need to be there for others. Curtis said going to meetings gives her information and the comfort of knowing she's not alone. When Austin lived at home and I was trying to get him help because I knew that he was using, I would hate to go into his room every morning, afraid he'd be dead, she said. My worst day with my child is a walk in Disneyland compared to so many people. My son is alive. Next in local crime news, trial in Wheeler murder begins. Decatur. It's been nearly 5 years since 17-year-old Mashira Wheeler was killed in a flurry of bullets that also wounded three others in a September 3, 2011 incident at 1502 North Church Street in Decatur. One suspect in that murder, Dennis Davis, was convicted in 2014 for the murder and sentenced to 100 years in prison. The trial for the other suspect, 32-year-old Roderick Dickerson, began Monday. Dickerson was arrested on October 10, 2011, and charged with four counts of first-degree murder and three counts of attempted first-degree murder. Last week, Dickerson waived his right for a jury trial in favor of a bench trial, which means the verdict will be decided by Associate Macon County Judge James R. Coryell. Assistant State's Attorney Christina Mullison described in her opening statement the scene from the night of the murder in 2011. Wheeler, known to her friends as Nunu, and her best friend had went from the home of Joel Magic Shoulder after Shoulder had promised Wheeler earlier in the day to give her money for her recent birthday. Wheeler, her friend, and two other guests at Shoulder's home were on the porch when at least two figures, Davis and, allegedly, Dickerson, emerged and unleashed at least 38 shots. Wheeler was killed and the other three were wounded. Macon County Public Defender Thomas Wheeler, representing Dickerson, said he's not arguing with the facts of the case, other than that his client wasn't one of the shooters. He said the judge would find the credibility of the state's key witnesses, quote, lacking. Following the 2011 murder, a witness who was described as close to Dickerson and Davis told police that before the shooting, he'd heard Dickerson and Davis say they were seeking revenge for the murder of family member Marvin Dickerson from August 22, 2011. The witness had also testified in Davis's trial, saying Dickerson and Davis were looking for the man who'd been accused of Marvin Dickerson's murder, Demario Cunningham. But on Monday, the witness, who was also friends with Wheeler, said he had trouble recalling the conversation he'd had with Davis and Dickerson the night of the murder. That part is kind of fuzzy, said the witness, who was wearing a jail jumpsuit. The witness's testimony was a struggle for both sides. He fidgeted and put his head down as Assistant State's Attorney Tammy Wagoner tried to get him to recount any details of the conversation with Davis and Dickerson. Are you aware of any part of the conversation that you had in respect to Cunningham? Wagoner said. Just the people wanted him dead, the witness said. Honestly, that conversation isn't coming to me. Then Wagoner's questions turned to the witness having seen guns in a van that belonged to Dickerson. The witness said he saw two guns, one 9mm and one .40 caliber, in a Pampers box. When Wagoner asked if he'd seen either of those two guns before, he answered yes, but then asked to speak to his attorney, Assistant Public Defender Scott Reuter. The witness had asked to see an attorney before beginning testimony as well. After his meeting with Reuter, the witness returned, described the guns, and said they belonged to Dickerson. On cross-examination, Wheeler asked the witness how he knew they were Dickerson's guns. I'd seen them before, the witness said. There are a lot of guns in Decatur. How do you know they were the same ones? Wheeler said. I'd seen them before and I knew what they looked like, the witness said. Wheeler and the witness also argued over whether the witness gave his statement to the Decatur Police Department because of a promise made to him to have charges in a domestic battery case dropped, and to have charges against his girlfriend dropped. Detective Joe Patton told you if you helped make his case for him, he could help you get out of a domestic battery. Is that correct? Wheeler said. No, the witness said. He always let me know he couldn't make any promises. Coryell called a recess for the day after several objections by Wagoner to questions to the witness. The case will pick up at 9 a.m. today with further cross-examination of the witness. Also testifying on Monday were two of the victims, both of them saying they didn't get a good enough look at the shooters to identify them. They did describe the incident, with the female saying the victim stood in shock as the shooters unleashed their attack before finally making their way into the house. Everything happened so fast, I couldn't see their faces, said the female victim, who was 15 when the incident occurred and is now 20. I just remember we all started running and pushing each other to get into the house. I was the third one to get in, and Nunu was last. She grabbed my leg as I ran in and I fell. She was just lying there in the doorway. One of the male victims, who was also wearing a jail jumpsuit, said he didn't see the shooters but went to his knees when the bullets started flying and tried to cover himself. He said he tried to get up but realized he'd been shot in the knee. I started trying to crawl in the house, but I saw Wheeler was dead, he said. I didn't want to crawl past her. It was messed up. Once I got in the house, I saw Shoulder just standing there like this, said the witness, who opened his mouth wide to mimic a look of shock. I yelled, "Call the ambulance!" The male victim who testified Monday had chosen Davis out of a photo lineup out of the murder. But like he did at Davis's trial, said he hadn't really seen any shooters and had only picked out Davis because he knew Davis was in custody. "I was just really angry at the time," he said. "I was angry because Wheeler didn't deserve what happened." Several members of the Decatur Police Department also testified for the prosecution. Detective Scott Klein, who is a certified crime scene investigator, said a total of 38 spent cartridges were found on the scene. 14 Winchester 9mm charges, 15 Blazer 9mm cartridges, and 9 CCI 40 caliber cartridges. Next in news from the City Council, City Council moves towards gambling changes. Decatur. Decatur City Council members expressed a desire on Monday to change the city's video gambling landscape. Specifically, several members said they wanted to consider imposing higher fees on the machines, as well as limiting the number of liquor licenses given to the parlor-type establishments. Comments came during a study session in which council members heard a wealth of data about the number and type of establishments in Decatur that offer the machines, how much money they take in, and how those proceeds are distributed. "I think you see an upward trend, and I don't know that there's any end in sight," City Manager Tim Gleason said after the meeting. "I think, to the majority of the council, they have concerns about that, which is why they wanted this information presented." Greg Zantara, the city's finance director, delivered the bulk of the presentation, which showed that the amount of video gambling in Decatur has ballooned. In December 2012, there were 3 sites with 14 gaming terminals in the city. In March of this year, 72 establishments had 338 terminals. In 2015, people in Decatur put nearly $70 million into the machines, and they took out almost $52 million. The difference, about $18 million, was divided among the machine owners, local businesses, state and city governments. The city of Decatur's share was almost $900,000. The council created a Class P liquor license for video gaming parlors in May 2015. Before that, Councilman Jerry Dawson, who was also the city's liquor commissioner, said parlors were abusing the Class G licenses that are meant for restaurants. Dawson said state lawmakers legalized video gambling in an effort to help bars, which were hurt by the smoking ban, and increased enforcement of driving under the influence laws. "It really was for the benefit of the taverns," Dawson said. "With that being said, I don't know about this other segment of the community that really don't want to go to the tavern, but they want to gamble." There are 21 Class B licenses in Decatur. Several council members said they would like to cap and ultimately reduce that number. The bulk of the council also appeared to support increasing the $20 per machine fee that the businesses with video gambling pay to the city annually. Zantara said the fee does not cover the city's costs to produce licenses for the machines. He presented information about the fees for comparable cities, which range from nothing in Champaign to $1,000 per machine in Urbana. In other business, the council approved multiple items related to sewer work, including 2 items that would begin the process of repairing the massive 7th Ward sewer. The council agreed to borrow roughly $15.3 million from the Illinois Water Pollution Control Loan Program at an interest rate of 1.86%, and to hire Bainbridge, Gee, Malansky, and Associates to provide engineering and inspection services for a cost not to exceed $944,000. The sewer, deemed one of the most critical by city staff, was built in 1905. It begins at the intersection of Leafland and Edward Streets and continues generally south and west, extending past Fairview Park. "I find it very exciting, very interesting at the least," Gleason said. "This is a nearly $16 million project. It just shows the commitment that this council has in investing in infrastructure and we wanted to share that with the community. Meanwhile, a little down the road, Mount Zion seeks grant for $300,000 bike trail project. Decatur. A plan to fund the connection of the village of Mount Zion's bike path with that of the county has the go-ahead from the village's board. But a wait on whether there will be grant money for the work will prevent any work from being done for the foreseeable future. That was the guideline put to the village's board of trustees, who voted unanimously during their Monday night meeting to go forward and seek grant money for the construction of a 1,600-foot bike path in the northwest part of the village. The proposed path would go along Harry Land Road from Sundance Drive to Baltimore Avenue, then turn south along Baltimore Avenue to the Glenwood Assisted Living Facility. The project is estimated to cost $310,000. And Village Administrator Julie Miller said they are hoping to receive a grant from the Illinois Department of Transportation's Illinois Transportation Enhancement Program, which helps cover 80% of the cost for alternative transportation options. If the village does receive the grant, the total cost of the project for the village would be $64,000. Grant winners are to be announced at the end of the year. With efforts being done at the county level, and within other nearby cities to add on to their walking and biking paths, Miller said the Mount Zion one could be a great addition to the region's long-term plan. Local municipalities have all realized how important these are and how much people want them as a quality of life issue, she said. In addition to the path, an at-grade crossing at the intersection of Harry Land Road at Baltimore Avenue would be built in order to connect the future Macon County bike path along Baltimore Avenue. If the village does not receive the grant, Miller said they would investigate Plan B options, which could include applying for the same IDOT grant or other available ones, or having the village's Public Works Department work on sections of the trail on their own. In other business, Deborah Welton was unanimously approved as the new village clerk. A graduate of Mount Zion High School, Welton began working at the village in March and will replace Joanne Malding, who is now full-time with the village's police department. In local higher education, Eastern Illinois University president says university is not closing. Charleston. Eastern Illinois University's president reaffirmed Monday that the university will not close in the fall and also offered detailed plans for additional budget cuts if Illinois leaders continue to deprive the institution of state funding. In a letter to the campus community, David Glassman said the university, in its current condition, without further dollars from the state, might have to implement additional cost-cutting measures to get by until tuition dollars start rolling in this fall. The most difficult upcoming financial challenge for the university, he said, will be in July and August, prior to the time when we begin to receive tuition revenue in late August. It is imperative that we refrain from any end-of-year spending of division and department operation and gift accounts. Further layoffs may be one of the cost-cutting measures. However, Glassman said this does not mean the university would have additional rounds of large-scale layoffs like in the spring. Our level of layoffs have already gone beyond efficiency to a level of inefficiency in several areas, he wrote. If any additional layoffs in civil service employees were to become necessary to bridge the summer months, they would be in the form of two-week, three-week, or 29-day emergency temporary layoffs. Those laid off would return immediately to their current positions, and no bumping activity would occur. While layoffs may still be on the table, more furloughs are not planned as a way to further cut the budget. Glassman said there are no plans to continue furloughs for any Eastern employee in fiscal year 2017. Also in the letter, the university president said for employees like Unit B faculty, assistant coaches, and those in student affairs who are waiting on decisions for reappointment into the next fiscal year, individual notifications will begin now and continue throughout the summer. I apologize for not being able to let you all know immediately, and realize the importance to you and your families of a timely decision, Glassman said. As previously reported, Eastern received a third of its fiscal year 2015 appropriation, approximately $12.5 million, in a stopgap funding bill at the beginning of summer. This funding is a lower appropriation than what was and is necessary to get the university through the summer without further cuts, officials said. Eastern initially asked for approximately $24 million to $28 million when the bill was ironed out. The state is now less than a month away from the start of next fiscal year, July 1st, without fiscal year 2016 and 2017 budgets approved. EIU has managed its finances prudently and effectively to meet the unprecedented challenges imposed by the state's budgetary gridlock, Glassman said in the letter. It has been incredibly disheartening to have had to negatively impact so many of EIU's outstanding employees through layoffs, furloughs, deferred salaries, and by asking all employees to work harder and cover more responsibilities to make up for the decreased employee base. Since the start of the layoff process almost a year ago, the university has cut 413 employees, going from a staff of 1,743 employees to 1,330, according to university officials. Factoring in recalls, 245 staff and 13 faculty have been laid off. This does not include 72 who retired, 43 resignations, and the dismissal of 40 extra help employees. Along with personnel cuts, the university has also had to stop hiring, postpone construction projects, and restrict travel and purchases to essentials. In a couple of news briefs, Alzheimer's series set. HSHS St. Mary's Hospital, in partnership with the Greater Illinois Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, will hold the 2016 Alzheimer's series from 10 to 11:30 a.m. on Wednesday, June 8th, in the Assisi Room. Learn about research in the areas of diet and nutrition, exercise, cognitive activity, and social engagement, and use hands-on tools to incorporate these recommendations into a plan for healthy aging. For more information or to register for the series, call Margie Muhlenbach at 217-464-2046. Shelbyville Young Eagle Flights. Young Eagle Flights will be available for ages 8 to 17, weather permitting, Saturday, June 11th, at Shelbyville Airport, West Illinois 16. Registration will begin at 8:30 a.m. Children must be accompanied by a parent to register. The event is sponsored by Decatur Experimental Aircraft Association, Chapter 274. Martinsville Heritage Days Festival. The Heritage Market, part of Martinsville's Heritage Days festivities this year, will feature handcrafted, repurposed, vintage, and antique merchandise. Vendors with creative works including wood carving, horseshoe art, metalwork, woods, pottery, jewelry, textiles, paintings, foods, and more will be open on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and Sunday from noon to 5. For a complete schedule, go to martinsvilleheritagedays.com. Admission and parking are free. We'll now take a short break and return in just a second with the Herald and Review for Tuesday, May 7th, 2016. We'll be back in a minute.